The last element in the book by Thomas More that we're discussing, that I wish to mention and discuss briefly this morning, is the legitimation of pleasure. I'd like to explain this. Instead of emphasizing, as medieval Christianity had done, the ascetic principle that figures so prominently in Stoic philosophy, that is, that a person should try to deny himself what may be his basic drives and instincts towards pleasure, which do not contribute to a definition of man, but it is only the rational principle, the human mind, that makes man what he is. Instead of following that line of thought, which had dominated ancient philosophy, ancient religions, and all of Christendom for many centuries, in the Utopia you find what appears to be a rediscovery of the naturalness and the innocence and the desirability of pleasure and pleasant experiences as a proper expression of natural reason itself. That reason itself does not deny the legitimacy of pleasure. In our own era, in our own civilization, our own culture, we take pleasure for granted. The television is made for pleasure, the movies, the theater. We want more and more leisure for pleasure. Ever so many things, ever so many aspects, most of the advertisements try to stimulate the pleasure principle. But that's new, and you don't recognize that. It is new in the world. It had an origin not so very long ago. Until recently, pleasure was frowned upon as something unchristian, irreligious, atheistic, sinful. There's a different tone in the Utopia on this subject. Let me read to you one or two brief expressions of it. Pleasure, the Utopians define as any state or activity, physical or mental, which is naturally enjoyable. The operative word is naturally. According to them, we're impelled by reason, as well as by instinct, to enjoy ourselves in any natural way which doesn't hurt other people, doesn't interfere with greater pleasures, or cause unpleasant after effects. I'll come back to the provisos a little later, but here I want to emphasize the positive contribution, the substantive contribution, but the first part of this sentence makes. The Utopians attach great value to special natural gifts such as beauty, strength, and agility. They're also keen on the pleasures of sight, the pleasures of hearing, and of smell, which are peculiar to human beings, for no other species admires the beauty of the world. No other species enjoys any sort of scent except as a method of locating food, or can tell the difference between a harmony and a discord. Utopians say these things give a relish to life. They'd never dream of despising their own beauty. overtaxing their strength, converting their agility into inertia. And of course, here you have a criticism of asceticism as a way of life, the self-denial principle. Utopians would never dream of despising their own beauty. They'd never dream of overtaxing their strength, of converting their agility into inertia, ruining their physique by going without food, damaging their health, or spurning any other of nature's gifts, unless they were doing it for the benefit of other people or of society, in the hope of receiving some greater pleasure from God in return. For they think it's quite absurd to torment oneself in the name of an unreal virtue, which does nobody any good, or in order to steel oneself against disasters which may never come. They say such behavior is merely self-destructive and shows a most ungrateful attitude towards nature, as if one refused all her favors because one couldn't bear the thought of being indebted to her for anything. Pleasure should be thought of as whatever comports with nature. Not artificial pleasure, but natural pleasures are emphasized. In the category of illusory pleasure addicts, utopians include the kind of person who thinks himself better than other people because he's better dressed than they are. That's artificial. That's not natural. And he goes on to explain, actually, he's just as wrong about his clothes as he is about himself. From a practical point of view, why is it better to be dressed in fine woolen thread than in coarse woolen thread? But he's got it into his head that fine thread is naturally superior, and that wearing it somehow increases his own value. Utopians make the distinction then between what is natural and what is artificial, and they cultivate what is natural. Intellectual pleasures and moral pleasures rank highest in ethical value in utopia, and therefore they give the most pleasure. That is, what is best is also most pleasant. And so intellectual pleasure is sought after. Moral pleasure is sought after. And a very important aspect, as we know from our past discussion, pleasure should be not only for others, but one should take pleasure also for himself. It is not merely a high value to try to make a life pleasant for other people, and in the meantime, make life insufferable for oneself in the process. But one should try to seek a life that is pleasant for others as well as for oneself. Here's his argument. Either it's a bad thing to enjoy life, in other words, to experience pleasure, in which case you shouldn't help anyone to do it. If it's bad, why try to give it to others? If pleasure is bad, why try to give it to others? But you try to save the whole human race from such a frightful fate. Or else, if it is good for other people, and you're not allowed but positively obliged to make it possible for them, why shouldn't charity begin at home? After all, you've a duty to yourself as well as to your neighbor. And if nature says you must be kind to others, she cannot turn around the next moment and say you must be cruel to yourself. The utopians therefore regard the enjoyment of life, that is pleasure, as the natural object of all human efforts. And natural, as they define it, is synonymous with virtuous. However, nature also wants us to help one another to enjoy life, for the very good reason that no human being has a monopoly of nature's affections. She's equally anxious for the welfare of every member of the species. So, of course, nature tells us to make quite sure that we don't pursue our own interests at the expense of other people's interests. Now, this is so new, so extraordinary in literature of our culture that I wish to make special note of it. As you know, the Utopia was written in 1516. Only a few years before that, in 1509, Erasmus wrote The Praise of Folly. He wrote that book in the home of Thomas More when he was visiting Thomas More and his family. He enjoyed being with More and his family so much that he was stimulated to write The Praise of Folly, which praises pleasure. The two books together with Rabelais, who lived at about the same time and who wrote Pantagruel and Gargantua in the same period, constitute a unique contribution to the new world that was beginning to move forward. And these three works deserve special recognition for making an important contribution. This was accomplished by people like Erasmus and Thomas More, who considered themselves, and as they were, in the mainstream of our culture, the philosophy of the Greeks and the Romans, and Christian thought. Erasmus was a very loyal churchman. Luther tried very hard to win him over on his side. The Pope offered him a cardinal's hat. He turned down the cardinal's hat, and of course he refused Luther's overtures. He wanted to remain an independent man, without any strings attached, but a most loyal Christian in the tradition of the Roman Catholic Church. And yet, and I needn't tell you about Thomas More's loyalty, and yet they found it possible within that tradition to uncover germs like the one that I just read to you about a man giving himself pleasure, not only seeking pleasure for others, but that he owes a duty to God and to nature and to himself to cultivate himself and to cultivate his own natural concerns and interests and instincts. Now, this was one of the chief discoveries and interests and contributions of what we call today Renaissance humanism. And from the point of view that I've just mentioned, and with the emphasis on Thomas More and Erasmus as great contributors to the Renaissance humanism, sometimes referred to as Christian humanism, they thought of themselves as Christian humanisms. They acted on the principle that all aspects of human life must be taken into account and valued and cultivated. They followed the maxim which has come down to us from the 2nd century BC from Terence: I am a man, I count nothing human foreign to me. Erasmus quoted that in The Praise of Folly. You find the Latin original of this saying inscribed on the bench in front of Goldwin-Smith Hall. Oh, no, excuse me, there's a difference. You find it over the door in Willard Street Hall, the entrance door, the south entrance door, if you turned around and looked over the door, at least last time I was in Willett Strait, it was still there. I part of the mural. Maybe one never knows. But the Latin is there, homo sum humani nil a me alienum puto. I am a man, I count nothing human foreign to me. Now, in the first passage that I quoted to you, and in other passages in the Utopia, it's a clear indication that Thomas More anticipated by some 3.5 or more centuries John Stuart Mill's utilitarianism and the utilitarian principle. The operative word, well, let me read it to you. Pleasure they define as any state or activity, physical or mental, which is naturally enjoyable. The operative word is naturally. And now the part, I've read all this to you before, but the part that I want to call to your special attention at this point. According to the Utopians, we are impelled by reason as well as an instinct to enjoy ourselves in any natural way. And here come the three limitations. Which doesn't hurt other people. Second, which does not interfere with greater pleasures, as you don't eat chocolates, which will interfere with the pleasure of feeling wholesome and in good health if your teeth are going to hurt and if other things are going to follow as a consequence. So you don't buy a lower pleasure at the expense of a greater pleasure. Or thirdly, or cause unpleasant after effects. Well, that's the, maybe I should have separated the two. The example I gave you is really of the third kind, but the interference with greater pleasures are any infinite number of examples that one could cite. Now, this is strictly what John Stuart Mill has developed in his utilitarianism, and when we speak of the utilitarian principle, we really refer back to this. Another expression of this. Utopians observe the rule that minor pleasures mustn't interfere with major pleasures, and that pleasure mustn't cause pain, which they think is bound to happen if the pleasure is immoral. And then, finally, for this purpose, lunch is pretty short because work comes after lunch. But over supper, they spread themselves, since it is followed by a whole night's sleep, which they consider more conducive to sound digestion. During supper, they always have music. And the meal ends with a great variety of sweets and fruit. They also burn incense and spray the hall with scent. In fact, they do everything they can to make people enjoy themselves, for they're rather inclined to believe that all harmless pleasures are perfectly legitimate. Now, this has been elaborated on by John Stuart Mill in the Utilitarianism. It also plays a role in his essay on liberty. We talk about crimes without victims. I'm not, of course, discussing that, but that somehow is also related to this problem. The pleasure principle may be considered in a way a key to the communism which looms so large in More's Utopia, as the argument could be restated this way. If men are freed from economic insecurity, if they don't have to worry about their economic insecurity, then they will not need to be preoccupied with the economic aspects of life, And then they may cultivate the pleasures in life and take pleasure in work and take pleasure in all aspects of life. The sensual, the intellectual, the moral, the religious, everything can give them pleasure. Once the worry and concern and the concentration on economic security is removed. Well, of course, this is a big subject that opens up all kinds of questions. We're not prepared to discuss them, but in passing and in conclusion of our discussion of the book, I think that one can say that each of us can readily think of people who have economic security. They have a lot of it. We all know them. We all know such people. But that doesn't mean that they spend their time in the pursuit of interests that Thomas More could respect. They seem to devote still a preponderant proportion of their time on economic aspects of life. That is the tie between economic security when one wins it for oneself and the higher values is by no means one that works automatically. It doesn't come that easily. We even know from our own time social systems that are dedicated to the maximization of economic security for everyone, but are not governed by the laws of nature or by the laws of reason, but by dictators and by totalitarian single parties that have a monopoly on power. So there are no easy solutions to the complicated questions that are at the heart of Thomas More's utopia. But the utopia still remains a very significant work because of the social criticism and the social thought that one finds in it. It is stimulating to oneself. The stimulation doesn't mean necessarily that one ends up where Thomas More's utopia ended up. He himself probably didn't end up that way. But it certainly repays one's careful study. Yes? This young man here, just a second. Well, the question is, if a person is legitimately concerned about his own pleasures, about himself, why should he be concerned about other people's pleasures? Provided, of course, his pleasures do not interfere with other people's pleasures and pursuits. Well, the answer of Thomas More would be that man is a social being and that he's bound to live by the laws of reason or of nature. And the laws of reason or of nature compel him to think socially and not merely selfishly. So that while he, by the same laws of reason and of nature, he should think of himself, he is also compelled to think of others. Yes? Speak up so that others could hear you and I could hear you more clearly, please. Well, Thomas More did not himself live as a utopian. Thomas More lived in the England of 1516. And in the England of 1516, one would end up in prison or in an insane asylum if he tried to live as if he were in utopia. We all make these adjustments. We see the better, but it doesn't mean that we necessarily can live the better. We live in a society which we cannot change. So you do the best you can. You try to live as rationally as you possibly can. You don't try to put yourself unnecessarily in a situation where you would be sentenced to death as Thomas More was. He couldn't help himself. He was pushed to the point where he had to accept death. It wasn't something that he invited. He wouldn't have said it was good, but it was the best thing that he could do under the circumstances. So everyone, no matter who writes a book like Utopia, there have been other utopias since his day. The introduction mentions many of them. The authors still have to live in a way which makes it clear that they are living in their own time, in their own society, and participating in their own culture. Now, in order to overcome the distractions, the spiritual distractions that Thomas More faced by living in his own time, what you are referring to is the fact that he wore a hair shirt. Well, wearing a hair shirt is a terrible thing for a person, unless you do it voluntarily for an extraordinary, transcendently important reason. You don't do it. But he did it because it was a constant reminder to him, no matter where he was, no matter what he faced, no matter what he was asked to do, he was always reminded by the fact that he was a Christian, that he was a man, that there were certain things he mustn't allow himself to do, to participate in. There are other religions, other cultures in which people wear things, I needn't tell you, many of you are perfectly aware of that, to remind them constantly, wherever they may be, by reason of the garment that they wear or the object that they have on them or what they may have on the doorpost of their home, that they mustn't do certain things. God is omnipresent, God is omniscient, their conscience will be with them wherever they are, and there are lines that must be drawn. The hair shirt worked that way, had that purpose for Thomas More. If he lived in Utopia, he wouldn't have needed to wear the hair shirt. And I think that's what you're referring to, isn't it? Any other question? Well, now, we move away in a manner of speaking, because I think everything that we talk about here seems to have a cumulative effect at this week. There are no disconnections there. The connections are built into the kind of problems and thoughts that we've been discussing. We begin a discussion of John Locke, who lived in the century following Thomas More's. His years were 1632 to 1704. He has been one of the most influential philosophers of the last two or more centuries. The influence of his thought on Americans particularly has been very clear and very great. You cannot read historically with an eye on the history of ideas, the Declaration of Independence, or the United States Constitution, particularly the Bill of Rights, without feeling indebted to John Locke. Now, the second treatise was published in 1690, the year after the Glorious Revolution, as it is called, of 1689, in which William and Mary came to the throne after the ousting of James II. Mary was the daughter of James II. She was married to William of Orange, and the two were brought into England as the joint sovereign, the two together, jointly acting as sovereign. So that there was the replacement of James by William and Mary, and there was the replacement of the supreme power vested in the king by Parliament. Parliament replaced in that as a result of that revolution, finally and firmly. Parliament replaced the king as the final depository of the power of the state. With William and Mary, the Catholic Church was finally replaced by the Protestant religion as the established Church of England. James II was a Roman Catholic. Now, there's no agreement among scholars as to the exact year in which